This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. One of the TV shows I enjoy is Girls on HBO, and one of the characters who drives me completely crazy is Shoshana, played by Zosia Mamet. Here she is talking about one of her favorite TV shows, Sex and the City.
You know, you're funny because you're definitely like a Carrie with like some Samantha aspects and Charlotte hair. That's like a really good combination.
Oh, thank you.
I think I'm definitely a Carrie at heart, but like sometimes Samantha kind of comes out. And then, I mean, when I'm at school, I definitely try and put on my Miranda hat.
Ouch, that's a classic example of uptalk and vocal fry. Well, today we want to talk about how we talk language trends and fads and accents, especially the famous Philadelphia accent. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mark Liberman is a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is Joanne Joella. She's a voice and speech coach. And Joanne, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Lovely to be back.
Both you and I were just, viscerally responding to Shoshana as she was talking about her favorite TV show, Sex and the City. I called it uptalk and vocal fry. Is that what you heard?
That's what I heard.
Likewise.
Is that what you heard?
Likewise.
And if I can talk to you as a vocal coach,
yeah.
We don't hear her ever take a breath.
Well, there's not a lot of breath behind the construct of something like this because there's just not enough flow of breath or breath support, so that's what we get.
And it's all at the sort of very almost in our head, right? It's almost at the very top of her register, her voice.
Well, you know, that's how it sounds at more high frequency because there isn't enough breath pressure to cause the vocal cords to yield more sound. So you're really working with that deficit. The breath isn't swirling enough through the harmonic, the oral cavity. There's just not enough to work with. So that's what you get. You get the little tiny little things constricted.
Well, it's interesting, and you do a very good imitation, I have to say. But what we see is she's sort of looking up, her body posture sort of weirdly off, mm-hmm. and making very interesting grimaces as you were just doing. Does that go along with this kind of talk?
Well, you know, I think what happens is the body makes an effort. When it doesn't have enough medium, in this instance, breath, right, it makes an effort to use what little it has and constricts and just tries to get enough pressure up there. And we don't have enough air to finish the sentence, so we kind of bottom out a little. You know, it doesn't, yeah.
And that's the vocal fry. The kind
and
of
that causes vocal fry, sure, tension and lack of breath. Yeah, absolutely. And if you have the breath and you relax the tension, then you can get the formations, and Mark can certainly pick up from here, the ability to make good speech sounds.
Well, even as a linguist, what do you make of this way of talking, Mark?
excuse me. I think it's good to start by going back to the basic physics and physiology of voice production. So in your larynx, in your throat, there are two folds of tissue with muscles running through them called the vocal folds or vocal cords. And when you vocalize, you bring them together so that they close off the flow of air from the lungs. Then pressure builds up behind the closure. That pressure forces them open. Air begins to flow through the opening, and as it does, it creates a Bernoulli force, which is the same thing that keeps airplanes in the air.
Really?
And it brings the two sides of the opening together. They slam together pretty rapidly, pretty hard. Then the pressure builds up again, and the whole cycle continues. And that cycle is a fast one. For my voice, maybe 100 to 120 times a second. For your voice, maybe 160 to 180 to 200 times a second. For someone for the clip that you played, it could very well be 350 times
sure
a second.
It sure sounded like it.
Speaking. Now, the thing is that this cycle, this process, this myoelastic aerodynamic process, applies any time you have pressure behind a sort of flexible seal. And so a good example of that is the Bronx cheer. You bring your lips together,
right.
You put breath behind it, And the same kind of thing happens, except that it's not a nice regular oscillation. Instead, if you were to zero in on that and look at it in detail, it would be very erratic. And that's actually what's happening in vocal fry. The balance among the pressure of the breath and the tension in the vocal folds is not in the regime that will allow a nice, clean oscillation, and so instead they begin oscillating chaotically.
But is this something new? And I have to say, I mean, I hear it on NPR, I hear it a lot of places, and it seems to come, I have to say, from younger women.
It's certainly not new. That is, you can, as long as there have been voice recordings, you can go back to recordings made in the 1920s or 1930s, and you can find exactly the same kind of phenomenon. Whether it's become more common among young women recently, mm-hmm. I don't think we really have evidence about that. It's possible that it is. It's natural for this to happen somewhat more for women than for men, because their voices are naturally higher. There's a secondary sexual characteristic. Male voices change at puberty. The larynx gets about 50-60% bigger. The pitch of the voice becomes about 70% lower on average. And so especially if a woman is trying to sound more authoritative by bringing her voice down into a lower register, but everything is kind of tight, it becomes more likely that you'll get this kind of chaotic oscillation.
And I think the thing that rankles me, and perhaps just as a woman, when you hear the kind of uptalk, it sounds girly, it sounds insecure, it sounds like she's ending every sentence with a question mark.
Yes, exactly.
You know, which to me says this is someone who's not necessarily sort of confident in their opinions, and I'm making very broad statements here. But what do you hear, Joanne?
But, you know, as Mark and I shared, sometimes generalities are absolutely true. In this regard, let me tell a quick story.
Sure.
That years ago I worked with a young woman who let me couch this way also. That this purr, we would call it in the bedroom, but we might call it a bit of a growl in women when they are trying to be authoritative. And this young woman was an attorney, a trial attorney. And when I met her, it was actually in a voiceover class, right? But instantly, when she started to speak, I thought, oh, my Lord, your career is maybe briefer than you think. You won't be able to speak, because she was speaking like this. She'd start to speak, but she'd end in something. And this would went. So I took her aside and said, you're really hurting your voice. She said, well, I said, why are you doing it? Do you know why you're doing it? She said, well, I need to be more authoritative. And, you know, when I was in law school, you know, my best friend was a guy, and he just took me aside, and he said, you know, young lawyer to young lawyer. He said, you know, you sound like a chihuahua, so why don't you growl a little more like a pit bull? And that's exactly what she was trying to do in order to assume a posture of authority.
And is that the sort of, was that vocal fry from your diagnosis?
Well, you know, and please, Mark, factor in on this. What I've observed is that people feel powerful down here, but that's us perceiving the vibrations and the constriction and restriction in the throat at the larynx. But the people who receive it are like, ugh, that's not sounding very good. But we who are generating it think it's mighty powerful or mighty sexy.
Yeah. What do you think, Mark?
As you take one of these systems that's producing this myoelastic aerodynamic vibration, and you...
that's the proper name, right?
one of these systems that's producing something like vocalization, and it's not actually just vocalization systems. This happens in systems that have some sort of nonlinear oscillation going on pretty generally. As you lower the rate of oscillation, you tend to get sudden period doubling, where suddenly the pitch jumps down by an octave.
Mm-hmm.
The period doubles, the pitch goes down by an octave. And that can happen repeatedly, and as it happens, then you degenerate into chaos. That is where the that's a technical scientific term, where the oscillation is no longer periodic, but instead is kind of boom, 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 boom. And that's vocal fry. And so this creak or very low-pitched voice and vocal fry are interrelated. But I wanted to get back to the stereotypic associations that you have with uptalk.
I do.
So the first thing to take note of is that there are parts of the English-speaking world in which uptalk is absolutely normal. In the north of England, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland, that's how everybody has been talking for 1,000 years. And it's not
with that kind of swing at the end of the sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some people who think that this is because of the influence of Scandinavian languages through the invaders who came across the North Sea and colonized those areas. But whatever the source, you know, people noticed this back in the 18th century. And it's certainly been true, it's probably been true for 1,000 years. It's also the case that there are plenty of American men who commonly use uptalk. Someone who did it quite a bit, actually, was George W. Bush.
Oh, yes.
And there also have been some studies that suggest that in certain circumstances, at least, men can do it quite a lot. Because one of the things that it does is it compels an answer from the person you're talking to.
Because you're asking a question, sounds like a question.
You're not exactly asking a question, but you're turning the floor over to them briefly for assent. Are you following me? Do you agree with me? And so, quite opposite to being insecure and girlish, it can actually be quite dominating. It can be a way of controlling a conversation, and you can see uses of that kind. You can sometimes see it in very aggressive sales pitches.
Huh. Oh, absolutely. I was going to say that. It's that bit of growl at the end, and men use it.
Yes.
And it's not. It doesn't seem to be as heinous when a male does that, because the voice is already low enough and rich enough that it comes across like the lion's growl, you know.
Well, I don't mean affectation in the people are conscious about it, but whether it just seems so much more common in this country. And again, you know, I don't know whether it's the influence of the Irish or it's just the way that languages work.
Yeah, the history is interesting and not well studied, as far as I know.
Yeah,
it's conceivable, for example, that the Scots-Irish immigrants into the Appalachian region and then through into Oklahoma and Texas and then the Okies in the Dust Bowl days into California actually were the cause of the Valley Girl, that aspect of the Valley Girl accent. That's rampant speculation. I don't know. But I think we have to be careful here about the mechanism of stereotype formation. That is, we get the idea that this is something illustrative of weakness on the part of young girls, and then when they do it, we notice it, and it confirms our impression.
Guilty as charged. That's Mark Liberman, and he's a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Joella, voice and speech coach. And yes, we're talking about things like vocal fry and uptalk and accents and how we talk. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's only concerto for the violin is as much about the orchestra as it is the soloist. The Philadelphia Orchestra is joined by Nikolai Schneider for Beethoven's Violin Concerto. Also, Stefan Denev conducts Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999 today. March 6th, 7th, and 8th at the Kimmel Center, Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Nikolai Schneider and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the Lost Region. One historian says the Midwest is being forgotten when it comes to American history.
There are no institutions that study the history of the Midwest. There's no Midwestern Studies Association. There's no journal that focuses on the Midwest.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with Joanne Joella and Mark Liberman. And the phones have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. Yes, thumbs up. We like to talk about how people talk for all the obvious reasons, and clearly so do our listeners. Joanne, I have some really basic questions for you as a voice coach.
Sure.
And I remember taking an acting class, and if there's one thing I took away from this acting class was that it's all about breathing and how poorly and badly and incompletely we breathe. Is that also true for just plain old talking?
It is so true for plain old living, Marty. I mean, the power of how we can use the diaphragm and know that when we were born, we were breathing in a way that was for our maximal benefit. And we call it diaphragmatic breathing or belly breathing when we're studying art or professional speaking or speaking in your profession. And acquiring breath the way it should be, relaxing the belly, letting the diaphragm do its work to move down, and you feel your tummy swell out, which, by the way, may be a problem with both men and women. We're going to make
they don't
it
want their tummy out, right?
They don't. That's not GQ. It's not, you know, L. But that is how the body should be functioning. And, you know, if I borrow from Oprah Winfrey and she says, regift yourself, this is a regift. You have the wiring to breathe very well, to acquire the oxygen you need, and to be healthier in mind, body, and spirit. But having that breath, it's your medium, it's what we shape, it's what we vibrate, and how we affect other people. You know, your voice is affects how you look even. You know, do you sound the way you want to look?
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Do you see it that way, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know as much about the relation between the physiology of breathing and higher levels of linguistic expression in the case of humans. But there's been some interesting recent work about songbirds that shows that the structure of the phrasing of their songs is actually governed by what started out as the wiring in their brains that controls their breathing. And so it's been kind of rerouted into the phrasing mechanism, and it wouldn't surprise me to find that there are connections of that kind in humans as well.
Sure.
And when you observe other members of the animal kingdom and watch the way they breathe, or watch the way a baby breathes, I mean, this is the power that we can acquire and really should. That's my mission in 2014, is to get that word out to everyone, but especially to the women who tend to have mastery over the upper chest. Which that constriction also would support that tiny voice if you're all constricted in your shoulders.
Well, that's a perfect segue into another. She's a very good imitator.
She's terrific.
Yeah, it's excellent. This is another clip we want to play, and this is from a 2013 film called In a World, one I really liked a lot. Lake Bell, she wrote it, she starred in it, she directed it, and she plays a voiceover artist who runs a class called Voiceover, the Vocal Makeover, Find Your Voice and Get Ready to Be Heard. And here she is talking to one of the students, played by Corsica Wilson. Let's listen.
Stacey, what do you do for a living?
I'm a corporate attorney.
Great. And I know you've been on a job hunt. How's that going for you?
Well, I've been interviewing for about 10 months.
And why do you think that is?
Because I sound like a sexy baby.
Which may be great for the bedroom.
Yeah, it is.
But am I really going to hire a sexy baby to defend me in a patent infringement lawsuit? Okay, so over the next 6 weeks, Lewis will be recording your voices, and we will listen to your sounds evolve right before your very ears. Because women should sound like women, not
baby dolls who end everything in a question.
Let's make a statement. Now, who's ready to be heard?
I love that clip. And Lake Bell calls that sexy baby vocal virus. That's the description that she has for this way of talking. I'm back to you, Joanne.
Such an important piece of information, Marty, is that you learn how to do this properly. I mentioned to you that Margaret Thatcher, for example, was criticized as having a very high, very pinched and annoying voice, and she studied to learn breathing. It's the bottom line. Breathing and then the relaxation that actually breathing affords. You know, those two ingredients, whenever I'm working with someone who wants to be a voiceover performer, an actor, or a corporate executive, is to have the ability to relax. That helps resonance, and it gives you the breath that you need to support your speech. Yep.
Well, Mark, I've been trashing all these ways that people are talking, and you're basically here to tell us, you know, that not to be, I guess, snobs about the way people talk. People talk the way they talk.
So I think the first thing to say about this particular issue is that I suspect women have been learning to put on a sexy baby vocal mannerism forever. But certainly for a long time. I found an interview with Carol Channing in which she talks about learning to do this, and she actually calls it the sexy baby way of talking in high school in order to win friends and influence people.
Ah, yes.
This would have been in 1929.
Don't be threatening as a woman.
Well, not only that, but be appealing.
Be appealing. And she had that lateral S. Yes. Carol Channing.
Yes, and she talks about also you know, learning to walk a certain way and so on, in order to persuade her mother that she wasn't the ugly duckling.
Oh my gosh!
And of course, to persuade the students in her class whom she wanted to impress. So I don't think this is something new. I think all of us, men and women, in different eras, have a variety of different ways of presenting ourselves vocally. And this is certainly one of them. And I think it's absolutely true that mode of presentation, you might decide that you shouldn't do it at all as a woman, but you certainly wouldn't want to do that as a patent attorney defending a case in court. On the other hand, there might be, maybe it would get you an acting job.
Maybe it would. Who knows? But I also think it, and perhaps this is just about communicating, which is knowing your audience. I mean, who it is that you're talking to, and perhaps you might change your accent or change the words that you use depending on who you're talking to.
Marty, people do that all the time. You have the professional voice, and you have the at-home voice and the social voice, and you can totally change the way you choose to pronounce words. And it's also a safety thing. You know, we still have enough animal, right, you know, to want to fit in with the pack.
Yes.
And another thing a woman will tend to do, more than a male, of course, is to lisp in a way. I'm not going to hurt you with my S. I'm going to lisp it, make it soft. Like that baby talk?
As opposed to...
So that you won't be threatening or that no people will like you because you're... Yeah. Oh, it's so sad when that happens.
Let me get... looks like Bob from Ewing to join our conversation. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Go ahead.
I have a kind of opposite end of the spectrum from what you've been talking about with the Valley Girl accent and all the other things, although I'm admittedly judge people on their accents, such as those. I'm a vocalist in a death metal band, and I have for about 10 years been going for the lower, deeper growl. And, you know, when I first started, it hurt a little, but, you know, after 10 years, it requires no effort, and I've learned breathing and all that to go along with it. And I was wondering, I guess the medical, scientific effects of that, or the, you know, things that go along with it.
Bob, can you give us a demonstration?
I think he has been.
Can you? and that's part of your act, part of
I'm
the performance.
Through a cell phone here, so it's not very good.
I understand, but you're really growling there.
I can go a lot lower too, but it takes a little warm up.
Right, and I guess the question is he hurting himself? Do you think, Mark? Is there any way to know?
I defer to Joanne about that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the vocal folds are sensitive mucous membrane kinds of tissue in there slapping into each other several hundred times a second, or at least 100 times a second. Yeah. But I notice in his regular speaking voice that he's producing what is called creaky voice nearly all the time.
Oh, interesting.
That is where you can kind of, just as when you see a movie, you're seeing 24 still pictures going by per second, and your eyes and brain fuse that into an illusion of motion. So in hearing, if you have a series of clicks, as you get to about 15, 16, 17 clicks per second, you no longer hear the individual clicks, but you begin to hear a tone.
Mm-hmm.
And you get up to 200 clicks a second, and you just hear it as a buzz at a pitch of 200 hertz. But if you're right in that boundary region, then you sort of hear a low pitch, but you also can almost hear the individual clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call creaky voice. And
Bob has it.
Yeah, well, I mean, anybody with a low voice can produce a creak, but he seems to creak pretty much all the time.
Do you think he's hurting himself, Joanne?
Well, yeah, and of course we have to defer to the otorhinolaryngologist here, but what I do know as a professional voice coach, who needs a speech teacher here, a voice coach, that damage is increased, and I'm not going to use the word exponentially, but damage to the vocal cords is more significant in the lower register. Are you about 25 years old?
Are you about 25?
I'm 36, actually.
36, wow, okay. Okay.
An oldster.
An oldster. And time is not necessarily on your side, because what Dr. Mark has picked up here is actually a warning for you that it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse as you continue to use any kind of use. Well, and I'll just say this, and then, Mark, you take over. Any type of vocal use is abuse under the best of circumstances, and that's why we get training. And just so that you know, for about 30 years of my life, I did a lot of rock and roll singing. I love it. My husband's a musician, and I just love ripping on that stuff, and used to do a lot of Janis Joplin, but I did it through excellent training, and that's why at 65 years old, the voice ain't too bad. Mark, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add that it could be that for a vocalist in a death metal band, damage is desirable.
But then will he be able to phonate at 45 or 55 if he still wants to do the death metal?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Bob, all I can say is good luck to you, and I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get another caller in, and then I do want to talk about the Philadelphia accent. And we have Ron from Montgomery County joining us. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, hi, Marty. I'll try to get this to you quickly so you can move ahead. But one thing that really troubles me today and concerns me in some respect is I hear so many women, even women who are on newscasters today, talking at almost a higher pitch than I would say is natural and normal, extremely with an extremely nasal quality and a lot of timbre in their voice. An example is a niece that I have who's 30 years old, and she still talks as though she's about 7.
Oh, dear.
And what bothers me is it seems that a lot of young girls grow up today they never get rid of that baby talk, you know.
So
I think personally it will become a handicap as they climb the ladder of whatever profession they're in.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ron, do you, Mark, share some of his concerns? Or as a linguist yourself?
I'm worried that there's a stereotypical association between lower-pitched voices and truth and authority, and that this stereotype privileges males and effectively discriminates against females just by the nature of our mm-hmm. species. Males have the secondary sexual characteristic that gives them lower voices after puberty. So it certainly can be true that women will pitch their voices higher than is natural to them
mm-hmm.
or lower than is natural to them, and males likewise for a whole range of reasons. But I want to be very careful about buying into the idea that a high voice is necessarily indicates a lack of authority or any kind of that you shouldn't listen because someone has a high voice.
Well, and it's so interesting that we do have these judgments, and again, guilty as charged judgments about how people talk and how we think about them. And I have to say, Joanne, when I listen to tapes of mine that might go back 20 to 25 years, I do have a higher voice. Now, whether over time it is just lowered as I've gotten older, or whether I have, you know, so jiggered it so that it can be more authoritative, I don't know.
When females age, and of course you're only 23, I know, but when females, as am I, well, females age, the voice tends to drop. The males, however, it doesn't. It's sort of that the dusty old guy, codger kind of voice. So, but I do want to say that perhaps we are reacting in a very primitive way to how sound affects us. I do want to say about news that, although in VO I'm always saying, don't send an extra voiceover, thank you, an extra amount of air up into the nasal passages when you're creating vowels. Vowels are voice, you know, and shouldn't, there's just M, N, and NG should come out the nose and that sort of thing. But in broadcasting, back when I was an undergraduate, that was where I, as a voice actor, I would say WHYY. But as a reporter, I would say WHYY. I would put a little more air out the nose for the extra high harmonic excitement. It's news, after all.
Of course.
We want to excite people. So that's an exception. Your listener should know that we're trained to be a little more nasal in news.
I do want to talk about the Philadelphia accent. And how would you describe it, Mark? What's unique about it?
The thing that's most unique about it is that although people recognize it, they don't know what characterizes it. It's there, but I have colleagues at Penn, Bill Above and others, who have been studying the Philadelphia accent for going on 30 or 40 years, and they can tell you, and I can echo what happens to this vowel and that vowel and what particular words are used and so on. But people all over the country and all over the world who can imitate well or badly a posh British accent or a Cockney accent or a Bronx accent or a Valley Girl accent, they may or may not get it right, but they have an idea about what it should be. They don't generally have a clear idea about what a Philadelphia accent is, and I'm not sure why that is.
Well, and I have to say there's some movies, Silver Linings Playbook, I'm thinking, and the Robert De Niro character had this so-called Philadelphia accent. No, he didn't. I mean, all the little nuances of it. What about for you, Joanne?
You can tell, if you're in this area, you can tell when it's not there.
Exactly.
I think that if I could just take one step back and really quickly, we receive information when it is presented without edge. And so this is something that I wish anyone with a high voice would just consider, that if you're delivering something with a sharpness, we're reacting, we're blocking, we're protecting ourselves. But if you deliver it in a softer, rounder, more acceptable way, we will accept it. We will receive it. Mm. Philadelphia is actually, I'm so sorry to say, guys, it has the most heinous reception in the industry.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and we'll find out why after this short break. Again, Joanne Joella, our guest. She's a voice and speech coach. She has a studio called Joella Arts. Also with us is Mark Liberman, and he's a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. And we've got a lot of callers at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra presents Mozart's Requiem, Saturday, March 8th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, March 9th at 3 p.m. Often referred to as his swan song, Mozart's final composition, Requiem, remains one of his most popular works. Introducing the newly formed Allentown Symphony Chorus. Also, cellist Christine Lampria will be featured in Barber's Cello Concerto. Information at millersymphonyhall.org. The Allentown Symphony Orchestra proudly supports WHYY.
Truth and justice, not necessarily the American way.
You see how people get caught in the system. And part of it is, I think, our adversarial system, which is not necessarily about truth. It's about, you know, winning or losing.
Filmmaker Alex Gibney examines the lost and found people in America's death row prisons. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
St. Joseph's University, a proud supporter of WHYY, offers more than 50 graduate degree, bachelor's degree, completion and transfer programs in business, arts, and sciences. An open house will be held on Tuesday, March 11th on the SJU campus. Program directors will answer questions about the many on-campus and online options available. Learn more about St. Joseph's University online at sju.edu/radio. St. Joseph's University. Live greater.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we are talking about how we talk with our guest, Joanne Joella, and with Mark Liberman, and again, an explosion of phone calls. But we want to know, Joanne Joella, why the Philadelphia accent is the most heinous in the industry, the voiceover industry.
All right. First of all, Philadelphians, I'm sending out a hug, and I want you to hug yourselves, because unless you want to participate in the industry, for example, you just go ahead and be yourselves and love every facet of yourself, because I do. I give you that. But what happens in Philadelphia, even as opposed to Boston, where I was raised, you know, we've got that pocket car, have a yard kind of thing. It's not the same as the out and the whom and the sounds by cat. There is a tight quality to that, that remember, you're the major tuning fork as you generate vibration, and we in your audience are the little quiet tuning forks that you actually start to vibrate and resonate. And if we don't feel good about that vibration, you know, then you have to be aware of it and make a decision. What do you want to do about it? Okay, so not putting you down, just loving you and asking you to be aware.
Beautiful. I mean, it seems like in Philadelphia, it's only, I think, a certain portion, perhaps the more a white population than a minority population, where everything gets pronounced or super pronounced.
In a certain way. I mean, I don't think a study of this kind has ever been done on American accents, but a few years ago, a British linguist made recordings of speakers from different parts of Great Britain. From speakers of so-called estuary English in the London area, speakers from Birmingham, which is, or Brummy, which is the most heinous, is viewed by Brits as being the most heinous accent, people from Scotland and so forth, people from Wales. And then he played these clips to two different audiences. One was an audience of people from Great Britain, and the other audience were people from continental Europe, from France, I think, but anyway, from other countries, perhaps from several other countries. And he asked both of them to say what they thought about the people who were speaking and also about the quality of the way of speaking. So among the British listeners, the Birmingham accent came absolutely at the bottom.
Wow.
It was regarded as nasal, as unpleasant, as harsh, as annoying. Among the continental listeners, it was actually towards the top. It was viewed as melodious and sort of nice sounding and so on. So some of this is not implicit in the sort of universal character of the sounds that the accent produces. Some of it comes from cultural associations that build up and stereotypes of the people involved. Now, how that has happened in the case of Philadelphia, I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I think it might very well be that if you were to take recordings of various regional accents in the United States and play them to people from Italy or Spain or France, that their ranking would be quite different from the rankings of Americans.
Very interesting. Let me get, looks like Susan from Northern Liberties to join our conversation. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. I think that the topic of regionalism is very interesting as far as I am a casting director, and I cast a lot of voiceover in the Philadelphia area. And a lot of people that want to get into voiceover are very regional. They sound just like they're from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem for this industry. As Joanne was saying, not in general. We want to give you a big hug. you don't need to lose your accent in general, but for the voiceover industry, one needs to have what's called a non-regional accent. And that is for the reason of probably national commercials. Some of these commercials are played around the United States. You don't want to sound like you're from Philadelphia.
Well, I appreciate...
I respect a lot of the actors that are in the Philadelphia area, because what they work on for many years is to get rid of their Philadelphia regionalism. And then they're able to put it back on when they need to for a role.
Well, that's very interesting.
Great.
Susan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. But, I mean, I guess a non-regional accent is a sort of, what, generic? Not generic way of talking, but it's you can't identify where someone is from.
It's non-distracting. If I were to do a VO, and by the way, Susan is a highly regarded professional in her field, so she's seen a lot of this, and hi, Susan, that if I were to do a spot for the Philadelphia Parking Authority and I was to discuss that on Wednesdays there's free parking, then in that moment I've just disconnected from a way that you've heard me speaking for a moment, and people, who is she? Where is she from? I heard this. That was different. You cannot do that. And if you listen to the national ads on radio or TV, it's generic or received would be a received speech, or either one, I think, would be inappropriate, but generic.
Susan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have an email from Stephen. What about the invasion of really? Where did that come from? How can we stop it? And I know I'm sometimes guilty of saying that. Really?
Whatever.
Is that something that you have observed, Mark?
I haven't noticed it, but I'll take a look.
That's the way language works.
Well, language does change all the time. One of the exciting things about being in this field, or just for that matter being a human being at this time with any kind of curiosity about these matters, is that we now have an easily accessible digital record of how people have been writing and talking for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And so the question, I haven't noticed a major spike in the use of really as an isolated question, but we can check.
Really?
Yes.
Or you can find in words like yada yada or whatever, right. Or they become the kitsch factory. You know, if you want to belong, it's sort of grouping. We all, if we say whatever,
sure.
We should know one another.
Let me see what Kelly from Conshohocken has to say. Kelly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I have a question about mimicking accents.
Mm-hmm.
I've traveled enough that if I'm around an accent, I tend to pick it up actually rather quickly. And I'm just wondering what's happening there, because it's unconscious. And I worry sometimes that people think I'm making fun of them because I do it so unconsciously.
I think that's actually an interesting question. I'd be curious about what you think, Joanne, whether that's just sort of either being a good mimic or wanting to fit in, or just feeling comfortable in a place and appropriating some of the... sounds?
Well, I'm going to take us to something we haven't discussed. By the way, I did that when I was in Scotland. I was standing speaking with a professor, a physics professor in Scotland, and I started mimicking him. I thought, oh, my God. We learn to speak because we're wired for sound. It excites us. And so we are wired to be able to, for better, you know, to one degree or other, depending upon how we process sound and our fine motor coordination and whatever, and our breathing, ladies and gentlemen. So I think what's happening, I wonder, do you play an instrument? Do you sing?
I sing, and I have played various instruments.
Of course.
Traveled enough, I feel like, that I've exposed myself to enough sound.
Yes, well, sound excites you. You are more of a sensitive in that area, dear, than others, perhaps. And so you just naturally gravitate. Your body, you're a shapeshifter. Mm-hmm. And your body just starts to form in those shapes because they excite you. You like them. And isn't that wonderful?
Kelly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark, do you think that we are in danger of losing regional accents? And I ask that thinking about how mobile people are, how sort of connected we are to the world, even immigration. Has that had an impact on what we think of as regional dialects that maybe in the past were more isolated, and so they sort of grew?
Mobility and immigration certainly have an impact, but the short answer to your question of are we in danger of losing regional accents is no.
Good.
There's even some evidence that regional accents are differentiating more rapidly than they were before the era of mass communications. But I wanted to come back to this question of resonating or accommodating to other people's speech. we're all shapeshifters to some extent in this respect. The sociolinguists call this phenomenon accommodation. For psychologists, it's perhaps an aspect of a larger phenomenon that they call priming.
It's mirroring, right?
We mirror the behaviors of those around us to variable extents, depending on how we feel about them and how we feel about ourselves. But there are some very interesting experiments that show that aspects that are not salient to us, that we don't notice consciously, nevertheless get accommodated. So, for example, if you make a video of someone explaining something, explaining how to do something, and you intervene artificially to lengthen the voice onset time of voiceless consonants. So when you say ta, when you say ti, when you say ki, there's a k, there's a release, and then eventually the voicing starts again, k, e. So that period of time might be 60, 70, 80 milliseconds. Suppose we intervene artificially and make it longer. So now it's 90, 100, 110 milliseconds in that short clip that we play people with the instructions. Now we have an interview with them where we ask them to read a passage. Their voice onset times will be longer. They won't be aware of the fact that they've done it. They won't have consciously even noticed the fact that in that video the voice onset times were on the long side, but it affects them unconsciously.
Yes.
And this is natural and human. It will not happen if the person giving the instructions in the video clearly has a foreign accent, because then you know these are things that you probably should, or at least it doesn't happen as quickly.
And it's all happening unconsciously, is what you're saying.
Yeah, or a lot of it is anyway.
We have a tweet from Sue. What's up with Matthew McConaughey's sloppy S? has anyone noticed that? He has a very, very southern, I don't know if it's Texas, drawly southern sound, and yeah, he does do something funny with his S's. I don't know. I'm looking into
it. Does he do it across the board? I'm not aware of this, if it's in his spontaneous speech or in a role that he's played. But it could just be a place where he defaults, like some of us do, well, he might do, so sure, I'd like to talk. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, something to get to the bottom of.
We will.
Well, again, we can go on YouTube and get lots of clips and check it all out.
Let's do it, Mark.
It's all good stuff. Let me get Pat from Northeast Philadelphia to join us. Pat, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I've an Aspie, so I got a combined Philly Aspie accent, and I've always been nasal because I have nasal allergies. Like, my nose is stuffed up due to allergies.
We can hear it.
I don't know. I wanted to know what to do about that, like the nasal part and the other part. My boyfriend thinks I'm sneering all the time. I sound like I'm sneering.
Well, is this the way you normally sound, Pat?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like you have a cold.
Yes, so I would suggest seeing an ENT specialist about that to see what type of actual blockage or whatever's going on with the mucosal lining, or maybe there's a deviated septum. I have no idea what it is, but I would see a doctor about it. Yeah,
indeed. Pat, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Ellen from media to join our conversation. Ellen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad you took my call. Good. I'm finding the whole conversation just completely fascinating because I'm a speech pathologist. What I wanted to say is that to change a dialect or correct a voice disorder or to even correct an articulation disorder, which is a misarticulation of a sound, such as the lisp, is incredibly difficult and requires a great deal of investment on the person, on the part of the person who wishes to make the change. They have to really, really want to, because they have to learn how to identify the error. They have to know how to produce it correctly. And then they have to anticipate it and hear it in both their own voice, and then anticipate it in what they're going to say, so that they can plug in the correct voice or the correct sound. And then they have to make it spontaneous, and they have to make it, put it into their own everyday speech. And it's really hard to do.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Ellen. Thanks for calling into Radio Times, and you're giving a knowing nod there.
That's a brilliant contribution, because one of the first things I say to a student who wants to work with me is, do you have a passion to make the change? Because I am telling you, and I have hopefully a lot of students out there listening, please, that someone can come in and say the word after. And if it with a Philadelphia regional sound, and I can say, now just drop your chin, just drop your chin and say it again after me, after. And you, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to get the absolute right. correct form. And then I say, but you've got to practice this. You have to retrain your body, your chin, to know that it should drop. If you don't have the form, you're not going to have the appropriate sound. You have to shape it. And so that's a lot of where people fall apart. They just don't want to put that time into changing themselves. It's almost an approach avoidance issue, isn't it?
Well, yeah. We're almost out of time here, but I want the listeners, Joanne, to hear. What did you sound like when you were growing up in Massachusetts?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Massachusetts, and I have a sister, and my mother and father, my father was a bus driver, and so I'm actually not doing an absolutely perfect New England sound. I'm not actually stopping my T's in my throat, because my niece will say, "Hi, Aunt Jo." Joanne.
So you've done a lot of work on your accent there.
At Emerson College, first year, and I was actually also Miss Sibilant S, so every time I said an S, it was like Tweety Bird was there, and Professor who taught said, no one gets out of this college without taking care of those issues, and I knew the game was on.
Well, maybe Matthew McConaughey said, deal with that S. Exactly. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I want to thank both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Learned a lot.
Great fun for me, too.
I'm glad to have you both here. And Mark Liberman is a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Joanne Joella is a voice and speech coach, both of them joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, I should say. And thank you for the calls and the email and the tweets as well. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's show. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.